Okay, thanks for your patience. If you're not deaf, we'll start after that. Welcome again to the Sunstone Symposium. This is session 321. Turning the microphone around, Doug Fabrizio. Our presenter today is Doug Fabrizio, a very popular radio host here in Salt Lake. He's been reporting for KUER since 1987. He became news director there in 1993. In 2001, he became host and executive producer of Radio West, a one-hour conversation and call-in show. And he's also the host of the weekly television broadcast Utah Now on Channel 7 here in Utah, which is the PBS station in KUED. And he served as a guest host on NPR's Talk of the Nation, and winner of just numerous broadcasting awards, and really a marvelous person to be able to listen to. I hear his show all the time and absolutely enjoy it. A couple of things, of course, if you have questions, I'll move the microphone when we get to that point back in the aisle. Please speak into the microphone. If you raise your hand and say, oh, I'll just be really fast, I'm just, you know, going to say something, I'm going to interrupt you and make you come to the microphone, or I will bring the microphone to you. And of course, remember to support our vendors in the harvest room. They will be here until this afternoon with their displays and also their books. And with that, let's turn the time over to Doug.
Thank you very much. Don't anyone stand in water and get anywhere near around here. Could be treacherous. Well, there's a technique in radio that I'm going to follow this morning. So it's this. It's get to the tape as soon as you can. So here goes. I want to play you a piece of sound. More than two-thirds of the Earth's fresh water is actually suspended in the form of glaciers and ice caps. It's there in the Arctic Ocean. Now, thousands of miles are covered by ice flows, and these humongous plates of frozen water are constantly in motion. They're shifting and buckling, and that's what you're going to hear. This tape was collected by a sound engineer somewhere near 80 degrees north latitude, midway between Barrow, Alaska, and Tuktoyaktuk, Canada. Now, keep in mind, this flow is half a mile wide. It's about a foot thick, and it's breathing. All right, I admit it. It's a kind of a gimmick to draw you in, but let me defend it. The intensity of that moment where you are captivated by something you hear is what I'm after this morning. Because I think it best helps me explain what we try to do with Radio West, and that's this. Listen. The moment I know an interview is working is when I completely lose track of the mechanics of the experience, the questions on a page, the microphone, the clock in front of me. And if I do it right, the interview transforms into something organic, an actual conversation. And the core element of that is the same kind of attention you were paying to that sound just then. You were listening, in the deepest sense of the word, not anticipating what happens next or what you'll say in response. When you listen, you put all of that aside, and you can actually hear the environment around you, like this. Several years ago, a curious sound engineer placed a tiny lavalier microphone inside the entrance of an anthill in Arizona's Sonoran Desert. He captured the sound of what entomologists call stridulations. This is ants rubbing two parts of their bodies together. It's how they communicate with each other. Now listen. Isn't that cool? All right, here's another piece of tape. Now, see if you can guess what this is. What do you think? Birds? No, good guess.
Hail.
Hail, no? Shingles, no. Not horses. It's the sound of lava flowing. Now, this was recorded in Hawaii on the slopes of Mount Kilauea. It's an active volcano. It was during an eruption in 1983. The sound you're hearing, that glass-breaking sound, is when it comes off the surface of the crust in the front and goes to the side and cools. It's moving at about 12 inches every minute. Listen again. I think my goal on Radio West and the goals of Sunstone this year are similar. That is, trying to figure out the meaning of the culture that has grown around Mormonism. And to truly detect it, I think, to understand it, you have to really listen to what's being said, because so much of this is reflected between the lines. Let me see if I can illustrate this. Last year, we had on our radio program a guy by the name of Fred Newman. He's a sound effects expert. Does many of the sounds for the public radio program, A Prairie Home Companion. And of course, he does these sounds with his voice. But this talent, this gift, is more than something physical. Newman pays attention to the world. He says, the subtleties of sound offer clues that connect us to the world in which we live. For example, Newman told us that when he rides his bike in Manhattan, where he lives, he doesn't wear a helmet. He says he wants his ears free to take in the sounds of the city. He explains that our sonic environment deeply affects the rhythm of our lives. So what's he saying? That it's about listening, something he understood from his earliest days growing up in rural Georgia.
I must have been about 4 or 5 years old, and I was in the backyard with my grandfather. The leaves were sort of quaking in the oak trees, like this. And I was talking, he said, shh, shh, shh. He put his finger on top. And he said, just listen. We sat down on the grass underneath there, and he just, we hear a bird, you know. He said, that's a wood thrush. Way in the background, you could hear, you know, somebody cutting a lawn over there. I was always fascinated by sounds, but it started out with listening.
I think it's important to remember that this is more than just a physical function. Listening is about using one of our most basic senses to become more aware of the world around us. Not just sound, not just voices, but of course the meaning that they express. When we listen more deeply, there's, and this is the important part, there's a payoff, not only for ourselves and the way we perceive the world, but for our community around us. But here's the sort of glitch. Listening requires a bit of work. In an age of so many choices, we could spend our lives only hearing from those who agree with us, only picking the melodies that are catchy or easy. Now, this is a particular challenge, I think, for people of faith. It's one of the things we've been interested in exploring in Radio West, that risk for believers in straying outside of the circle to listen to what's being said in the world. Former BYU philosophy instructor Jeffrey Nielsen ran afoul of his school and his church earlier this year when he spoke out about gay marriage. But even more interesting is what Nielsen said about Mormons embracing the torrent coming from the information age. He spoke with us in June.
Well, again, it comes back to what it means to sustain your leaders. To sustain your leaders mean unquestioned obedience and compliance. Or can I, in the process of coming to sustain my leaders, can I question, can I examine? Do I have that privilege to do that? I think I do. And I think our failure to be open and transparent in matters of church history is harming right now real families and real individuals. It's causing turmoil and stress. And I think we can be honest about the warts of the past by failing to honor the warts and also to see people are being harmed. They're being hurt unnecessarily.
For church leaders and the particularly devout, this new era must be terrifying. But what we found in our interviews with Mormons and the calls we get from Latter-day Saint listeners is not a collection of faithful Luddites, but people with an extraordinary level of spiritual maturity wanting to engage, but wondering about the consequences. I haven't drawn any conclusions about this. That's certainly not my job, but I'm constantly touched by the tenacity of Mormons determined to cling to their faith. And who better to express this than Gary? Gary's the Mormon kid in the mythical land of South Park. I hope I don't have to set this up much, and don't worry, I've bleeped this for the more sensitive. This is Gary, of course, of that mythical mountain community of South Park.
Liz, I just want to let you know you don't have to worry about me trying to be your friend anymore. You know? Look, maybe it's worth doing these crazy stories that make absolutely no sense. And maybe Joseph Smith did make it all up. But I have a great life and a great family. And I have the book of Mormon to thank for that. The truth is, I don't care if Joseph Smith made it all up. Because what the church teaches now is loving your family, being nice and helping people. And even though people that this time might think that's stupid, I still choose to believe in it. All I ever did was try to be your friend, Sam. But you're so high and you couldn't look past my religion and just be my friend then. You got a lot of grown up to fight. So, awesome.
All right. Earlier this week, we actually spent some time talking about this episode. And it's interesting that whatever you think about the conclusions that they drew about the Mormon story, the creators of South Park, Matt Parker and Trey Stone, do seem to empathize with the idea of living with that conflict between knowledge and faith.
I like the end of this episode where it comes around to that point, though, of like, yeah, it's stupid. Even, I think a lot of people who are religious, they even kind of know, all right, it is kind of stupid, whatever. But if I kind of do this little playtime thing, it works for me. So
no, that's why I think the healthy people are the ones that are in, which is why I have a lot of good friends that are Mormons, good friends that are Catholics. And it's like the ones that are healthy are the ones that are like, these are stories that help tell me how to run my life. And these are stories that help mold, you know, mold society. And that's what they are.
So, what does this mean in the larger sense? Because I think the implications of listening extend out from ourselves to the larger society, or even more appropriately, to this community, one, as we know, that is deeply divided. One of the reasons we stop listening is that we think we've found the answer. The 20th century theologian Reinhold Niebuhr said that man has always been his own vexing problem. While Niebuhr acknowledges the great virtues and graces of America's Puritan ancestors, he did say this about them. He said, "I've become convinced as I read American history that the doctrine of special providence represents the real defect in our Puritan heritage. These Puritan forefathers of ours were so sure that every rain, that every drought was connected with the virtue and the vice of their enterprise, that God always had his hand upon them to reward them for their goodness and to punish them for their evil." Now, Niebuhr says that these religious instincts are, in fact, natural. He believed this idea actually, though, closes the great structure of life's meaning prematurely. He says that structure is that tension, and that tension is constant. Niebuhr says that humans should try to find a way to live their lives without the expectation of a culminating moment when all will be well. Human beings, he said, live in the tension between nature and spirit, between knowledge of our mortality and our intimations of transcendent meaning. Our highest hope and calling, he said, is to live responsibly in this tension. So let me see if I can reconnect all of this to community and back to listening again. Listening, I don't think, has ever been more important than it is now. In a time when there's so much information available that it all blurs together and it can lose its meaning, the total amount of information is said to double every 2 or 3 years, and yet we're told we can't use 95% of the information we have on hand. And so here's where the work of listening comes in, spending the time and trying to slow the rush of sounds to hear the whole story. And story is an important word here, a very important word, because we're all primed, we're all built to hear stories. A few years ago, a reporter at the radio network I'm affiliated with, at National Public Radio, Scott Simon, was making note of the shrinking soundbite in the coverage of presidential candidates. In 1968, he explained, the actual words of a presidential candidate on the evening news would be run for an average of 43.1 seconds. Now, by 1988, that time would have been snipped to 8.9 seconds. That was 10 years ago almost. Imagine what it is today. To give us a sense of the difference now, Scott played a clip from Winston Churchill's first speech as prime minister in 1940. It was a national radio address, the day after the German invasion of France, and maybe you've read it. Behind them, Churchill says, behind us, behind the armies and troops of Britain and France, gather a group of shattered states and bludgeoned races, upon all of whom the long night of barbarism will descend, unbroken even by a star of hope, unless conquer we must, as conquer we shall. Now, what's great, I think, about this clip that I'm going to play for you is how difficult it is to understand it. Imagine yourselves having to move closer to the set as you sit around the radio with your family and listen. Now, in this little exercise then, Scott imagined how this speech would be covered or explained today in the current media universe. Probably something like this. Here's the news anchor. Germany is poised to conquer the world. Britain's Prime Minister Winston Churchill today pledged. It's a good soundbite, but as Scott said, all you really miss there is eloquence, imagery, and subtlety. I think a lot about that media universe when my kids are loading music into an iPod or surfing through television channels, and I wonder what the effects of all these choices are going to be, what it means to have so much control over content. Last winter, the writer and scholar Christine Rosen joined us to explain what we know about the effects of technology on society. Rosen says that the gadgets like the MP3 players, TiVo, even your television remote, are diminishing our ability to formulate a sense of taste or develop a deep understanding about art. And she says, this facility to surf through a growing number of channels is isolating us from people who don't share our ideas or confirm our beliefs. She put it this way, unless we're careful, technology can take from us the capacity of being surprised. Let me see if I can explain this point. When Maggie, my daughter, chooses the songs for her iPod, she uploads the greatest hits of her favorite bands. We all do that. But Christine Rosen explains that music, like literature or information, is never just isolated, that it was created in a context that we miss out when we don't listen to the deeper, or listen deeper to the other work that's been created at the time of the big hit. All right, let me explain it this way. Here's a theme. It's a melody from Beethoven's Sixth, the Pastorale. And Beethoven is using the simplicity of this theme to draw us in. But left alone, it wouldn't have its fullest meaning. Now, listen again to this. Beethoven is developing the theme now, right? He's working it out. And he's taking us with him in the process. Now, sometimes it's not always easy to listen to. Sometimes it's atonal or dissonant. But without this part, you wouldn't have the payoff, which is the spectacular finale that ties it all together. I think what I've learned over time as an interviewer is that it's so crucial to listen when you're telling a story. And Ira Glass, the host of the public radio program This American Life, says we're all hardwired, as I said before, to hear stories. It's something that he came to understand when he was studying this kind of obscure subject in college. It's called semiotics. And the way Ira explains semiotics is, any of you studied semiotics in college, by the way? I knew some of you had to in this crowd. Well, you correct me if I'm wrong, but the idea of semiotics is not necessarily what the story means. You know, not like, well, what does the sea mean, or the boat, or the fish in a Hemingway novel. But why is it that a story is so captivating? What is it about a story that works, that sort of draws us in? Now, those of you who know Ira Glass will know this technique. When I was talking to him, this was a couple of years ago, he grabbed a CD and he put it in a CD machine to explain this point, the draw of stories.
Okay, so it begins with me saying something like, I'm sort of doing this from memory, but something like, you know, so Brett is standing on the subway platform, rush hour, he looks down at the platform and he sees this guy, and the guy's walking to one person after another. And as this guy walks up to each person, the guy stands very close to each person, says something very quietly, moves on to the next person, one after another, walks up to the person, stands very close, says something quietly, moves on to the next. And he doesn't seem to be begging, and he's cleaning up. And as he gets closer, Brett can hear what he's saying. And what he's saying is, okay, at that point, God, nobody turns off the radio.
And why? Why does no one turn on off the radio? Because we want to know what happens next, right? We want to know the end of that story, and that's the way all stories work, and they're completely built around this concept of listening. You're drawn in by the details of this particular weird, kind of quirky story. What is going on that platform? Now, I've told this story as a way of illustrating it a couple of times, and I've forgotten to tell the rest of the story and been nearly attacked from time to time. So I will tell you. Do you want to know the end of the story? Okay. So what happens is, Brett's watching this guy on the platform. Of course, he goes up to someone, and he's talking to people. And as he comes closer, he can hear him. He'll stop at someone, and he'll say, "You're in." Next person, "You're out." Next person, "You're in." Next person, "You're in." And Brett realizes this guy's kind of lost it. What does that mean? "You're in, you're out." But Brett realizes as the guy comes closer, he keeps hoping that when he gets to him, that he's in. Dan has asked me to tell who some of my favorite interviews are. And you would think that interviewing the Dalai Lama would have been one of my favorites. And let me explain why it wasn't. You remember when the Dalai Lama came into town a couple of years ago. And there were three of us who were chosen beside the press conference to be able to interview the Dalai Lama. Peggy Fletcher-Stack of the Trib, Elaine Jarvik of the Dez, and me. Which was a great honor, and I was really excited about the prospect of it. So we got together, we three, and started formulating the perfect questions. They were only going to give us 30 minutes, and they were pretty spot on about that. He had, as you may have known, a State Department security crew that was following him around, and they were very specific about sticking to schedule and those kinds of things. And so we had 30 minutes, and so we sat down and we figured out what would be the right questions to ask His Holiness the Dalai Lama. This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. What do we do? And so we sat down, and sadly, we crafted the most laborious, pretentious, silly questions imaginable. What is the meaning of life? I mean, stuff sort of on that level. I can't even remember what they were. They were so kind of silly, is the word. But we thought we had sort of, we distributed them properly, and this is how it was going to work. We were supposed to run this thing on KUER at 6:30, this half-hour interview. So I got ready before, and I prepared an open. I wrote an open, got it ready sort of for the introduction, because I knew I was going to have much time between the interview and the time it got on the air. So I had my deck. They wouldn't allow us an engineer. So I had to record this thing myself. So I set it all up, and we were going to get there at 5 o'clock, do the half-hour thing. That'd give me about an hour to work my way back to the station and get it all set up. No big deal. Well, of course, despite the sort of intensity of the security detail, they were running late. And it got to be about 5:30 when they finally arrived, and about 5:40 by the time we actually started rolling tape on this 30-minute interview. 5:40, 5:45. It meant it was about 10 after, quarter after 6 by the time we were finished. I didn't even have time to rewind the thing. I just got in my car and drove back up to the station and put it in the machine, rewound the tape, got it all set up, ready to go, and pushed play. And there was nothing on the tape. I thought, no, that cannot be. So I went to another room, put it in the machine, push play, and there was nothing on the tape. There was nothing on the tape. And I look back on it now, In fact, I don't know if any of you know Hal Cannon of the Western Folklife Center. He told me later, he said, yeah, no, this happens all the time when we interview like shaman and medicine men and Native American. This happens all the time. And I think in some ways there was some great mercy in the fact that that tape didn't actually show up on that. The sound didn't show up on the tape. Because, like I said, it was a really not a very memorable interview. And I remember the one question, one of the questions I tossed out. I had read that the Dalai Lama likes to collect and repair wristwatches. For some reason, monks love watches. And he loves to repair wristwatches. Now, tell me, wouldn't it have been a better story to find out why the Dalai Lama likes to repair watches than the meaning of the world? I think for me it would have been. And it provided a really important lesson for me, I think, in terms of the way to prepare interviews and what to expect. Now, back to listening. For those of you who find yourselves reading biblical scripture from time to time, thumb through the scriptures one day, and you'll see God is constantly trying to get your attention. Hearken to me, O people, and give ear to me. O my nation, give ear. O heavens, let me speak. Let the earth hear my words. Incline your ear. Behold, lo, hark. Put in terms that most of us understand, it's God saying again and again to some pretty restless children, all right, everybody, listen up. And this is at the heart of one of my favorite interviews of all time. And I cannot explain what it is about this interview. The interview that we did with a man by the name of Gene Jacobson, World War II veteran, a survivor of the Bataan Death March. I don't know what it is about this interview that I think is my favorite. In some ways, it wasn't that extraordinary, but in some ways, it touched me in a kind of deep way. What I learned from Gene Jacobson is that torture and despair makes you humble, and it makes you listen. Jacobson said that as a young Mormon kid in a Japanese prison camp, he wanted to do right by the Lord. So he paid attention, and he kept his faith, and on Liberation Day, there was a payoff.
We got out of the parade ground, and the commanding officer got up on the platform out there, and we were all lined up in rows of 50. And I looked at him and I said to myself, this may be your day, Jacobson. And he gave a short speech through the interpreter, but he said, the war is over. The Allies have been victorious. Tears, a big tear running down his cheek, he was crying when I said this. And you know what? I was saddened by him. I felt sorry for him. Because he was really suffering. You could tell he was. But I also had a feeling of joy come over me. Now that's the first experience I've ever had with joy that I ever had. And you know, I've been happy all my life. Even in prison camp, I tried to stay as happy as possible. But I have never experienced joy. And all the hatred that I had for the Japanese evaporated. And I found myself forgiving him. And you know, I'm not sure I had any right to forgive him. And I cried, and I know I cried, and I laughed, and I must dance a little bit, and you know, it was so great.
We had this thing that we do with Radio West at the end of a show, called, you know, the post-mortem, where we sort of go over and talked about what worked and what didn't. And part of the process is grading a show. And I try to sort of maintain a very high standard, because I think unless you do that, you get complacent. And our interview with Gene Jacobson was the only one that has ever gotten an A. And again, we've talked to some amazing people, but for some reason it really resonated. And I think for me, because we've done shows about compassion and we've done shows about forgiveness, and I think that idea of forgiveness, where he came, really worked. And that moment when I was sitting in there, like I sort of explained before, you know, that moment where you completely lose track of everything that's around you because you want to know what happens next. And you're so intent. and the everything else around you. Imagine yourselves camping, if you've been. And, you know, you get off the road, and you hear that silence, and there's such clarity in that silence that there's that kind of hiss. Well, imagine the times when you're listening intently, and everything around that, everything but that focus is just that sort of hiss, that noise, and you're completely focused. That's what I want, and that's what I want to get at today. Now, speaking of forgiveness, listen how listening comes into play in this. In the 1990s, South Africa had tried to find a way to get past the atrocities of apartheid. They created what they called the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which was designed to get the community to resolve the ugliness of the past. So essentially, you have this commission trying to heal a country, trying to find a way to move on. And they came up with an idea of forgiveness, essentially. This is what they decided. They decided that if people who had committed these horrible, unspeakable crimes would admit to what they had done, would just come out and say, we had done this, they would be forgiven. The South African theologian Charles V. Vincenzo said this. He said, as a government commission, we could not reconcile the nation. We couldn't just offer forgiveness. All we could do was try and create a space within which people listened to one another. And to the extent that a greater depth of understanding, of being aware of what drove people to do these dreadful things, as that understanding began to emerge, so the morality began to flow in. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission applied the African concept of Ubuntu to their task. Now, Ubuntu isn't easy to translate. It's a notion. It's an idea. An idea that identity is formed by community. And it isn't explained any more eloquently than by the Archbishop Desmond Tutu when he spoke to us in February of 2002 in an interview I regard as one of the most meaningful of my career.
Ubuntu is the essence of being human, of being a person. And in our understanding, you can't be a solitary human being. And so we have a saying, a person is a person to other persons. Ubuntu, Ubuntu. I need you in order for me to be me. Therefore, we are part of what the Bible calls the bundle of life. You wither if you are detached from your community.
My kids and I love the group, The Counting Crows. And there's a line I often point out in the song to them. It's called Lullaby for Mrs. Potter. It goes like this. If you've never stared off into the distance, then your life is a shame. I thought about that last year when I was camping with my 12-year-old son, Jack. We weren't that far up Centerville Canyon. In fact, you could still see the Home Depot from where we were. But you were far enough so that the sound from the city below had disappeared. And if you listened, you could hear that hiss that I was mentioning before, that hiss that makes you aware of everything around you. Now, here's another piece of tape. In 1965, two physicists were trying to measure the intensity of radio waves emitted from gases surrounding the galaxy. Instead, they recorded this signal. It's microwave radiation coming from all directions in space. They're believed to be the echo of a 15-billion-year-old explosion. Actual evidence of the Big Bang. Now, when you play it through an amplifier, it's the oldest sound you'll ever hear. And I often think that maybe this is what eternity would sound like. Just listen. Uh, Okay. Here's the payoff. Listening isn't always easy. Life is full of distraction and time is always precious. But when we do, at some point, we're rewarded with understanding or peace or one magnificent moment of grace. Thanks a lot.
We've got about 15 minutes, a little bit more for questions. Line up and ask Doug some questions.
Hi, Doug.
Hi.
I just have to start by thanking you for your work. You know, there's a lot of people here that were probably educated, had educated parents, and who read a lot, but there's a big chunk of people out there who aren't inclined to read, maybe aren't inclined to get familiar with issues. But they may be listening to the radio in the shower or driving around in their car. And the interviews that you do and the work that you do has the power to pull them into something that they wouldn't otherwise feel inclined to be interested in. And I feel like it's transformative in people's lives. And I regret that more people don't know your name. Although I'm sure a lot of people do. But people like you and Terry Gross and Ira Glass and Ray Suarez before he sold out, you know. really do important work. So you guys are heroes to me, not just for what you do, but for the jobs you have. Since you asked the big question to Terry Gross in your interview with her, when you asked her if she was gay, I'm going to ask you a question, put you on the spot.
Okay.
And it's sort of a three-part question. Have you ever been, or are you now, LDS? And I ask you that because you seem to have such a deep understanding and interest in the LDS faith and the community. And I ask you that sort of asking, what brought you to Utah and your interest in LDS things?
Okay.
And then as a follow-on, what's the risk that Utah might lose you to bigger and better things?
Okay, well, let's see. Well, I'm among friends, right? You know, I hate that question, but I'll answer it. Let's see if I can do it in a sort of very straightforward way. I used to love the way Neil LaBute, who we interviewed yesterday, by the way, and I guess he's come back and forth into Mormonism, and he's out now, I guess, but Lord knows what'll happen in a couple of months or whatever, who knows. Somebody asked him once if he was Mormon, and he said, I am, just not a good Mormon. And I think that's my answer. I'm a Mormon. I'm the Sunday school president of the Yale First Ward. I grew up in Bountiful, Utah, in the Bountiful 16th. And that's where my kids live. I live in Salt Lake. So I can't leave them now. You know what I mean? So that's, is that simple enough and straightforward? But, okay, yeah, I'll leave it at that.
Doug, tell us what your biases are and what you have to do to prepare yourself so that you can listen.
Yeah, oh man. This should be directed to my wife. By the way, Alice, who's running the... Let's give her a hand. My who's not Mormon, by the way? I knew you were going to ask at some point, so I thought it. I have a lot of them. I don't like closed-mindedness. I don't like disrespect. I don't like bullies. And there have been times, I won't mention any names, that would totally reveal everything, when I've deliberately asked some of these people that I don't agree with to be on the program, not because I want to take a shot at them, because that is not my shtick. In my mind, I think it's about revealing truth. And if I go after to try to beat someone up or something like that, it's not going to work. It puts them on the defensive. And I don't want to sort of paint a fake grin on my face and try to be their buddy either, but I want them to be comfortable because I want to reveal the truth. And so I've had people like that on our program to give them a chance. And it's a good challenge for me because, you know, to be honest with you, I do have certain sentiments about certain things. But look, I always come back to this. So I prepare myself by confronting it. That's the answer, sort of. That is taking it on. Because, again, it goes back to this idea of listening. P.J. O'Rourke, the conservative who used to write for the Rolling Stone, he writes for Atlantic. He's a funny guy. I don't know if you know his work. He wrote this piece in the Atlantic a couple of months ago. What was it called? I Agree With Me. Talking about, I actually thought about using a quote from it in this, that, you know, we could really spend all of our times just reading people and listening to people who completely agreed with us. And so I'm always sort of trying to, what did he say? He said, when I'm driving in the car, I don't listen to Rush Limbaugh because I agree with him. And he said something about listening to the whiny liberals at NPR, I think is what he said. And so I try to confront it. I try to expose myself as much as possible. And it's not always easy, but I always come back to this also, that this Radio West is not about me. I don't try to insert my opinion or share myself in that way. Because Neil Conan said something from NPR once I think is really terrific. He said, opinion is boring. Story is interesting. And I think that too. Who gives a damn what I have to say? So.
You're familiar with the Mormon drive for family history. I myself, since the age 14, I have been running around with a tape recording, taping interviews with all my old ancestors, with all relatives before they would die. What would be your advice for me when I was 14 years old, running with a tape recorder and taping stories from my relatives?
What's my advice? Well, beyond just do it? That's the advice. That's absolutely the thing to do. I went to my family, my dad, my grandfather, Charlie Fabrizio, Pasquale Di Pasqualetti Di Fabrizio, showed up in the Uinta Basin of Utah when he was a young kid after a hellacious, horrible experience. He had a bar and a grocery store, a dance hall. This is in Hanna, Utah. Has anyone been to Hanna, Utah? They have a really cool store there that if you would drive by in the past, it used to say Fabrizio's and Sons Mercantile. I adored that store. And we were at a reunion a couple of weeks ago, and I took a tape deck with me to interview one of the last surviving, my grandfather's been dead for a number of years, one of the last surviving members of that generation. Now, my grandpa DeFay is also a, when a certain strain of the DeFabrizios arrived at Ellis Island, either they decided or some sort of clumsy immigration guard said, let's cut off this sort of untidy part of DeFabrizio and DeFay will be, so you meet a lot of DeFays. At least that's the story that I heard. It's probably different from some others, but it's a good story. And so my grandpa DeFay, who was also settled in that region, was a great bootlegger. And he had the coolest copper still. And one of these stills is still around that this guy I interviewed, they call him Snooks. What's his name? Do you remember his full name? Snooks. Everyone had a nickname in the Uinta Basin. Everyone. And this guy's name was Snooks. So I interviewed Snooks. and just asked him questions. And, you know, in many ways, you just have to get him started. And that's what you do. You just sit down and ask him. Now, look, how do I do it? I create a narrative. I think about story, about interviews in the same way I do a story. That is, I say, there's a beginning, there's a middle, there's an end. It's a symphony. There's a melody that draws you in. There's a development phase. And there's the coda at the end. That's how I see it. So you could craft them that way. That is, find some purpose for your interview. But, you know, in many ways, just get them talking. And don't wait. How old is Snooks? 90-something? He's moving around, barely moving around, but he was great, and he told the stories of, and he still has the damn still. And he showed it to us, and he would offered us a snort. I don't have any advice beyond just absolutely do it, because you can sift through all that crap later. But having it is the way, and you will cherish it. Look, I have voicemails. I get teary-eyed once every 45 days, or however long it takes. You know how the voicemail, they'll say, you've had this voicemail for 90 days, and it's going to be deleted unless you resave it? Well, I keep saving the damn things, because I have my kids, my son Charlie and Jack, and my kids, my wife calling me on 9/11, asking me where the hell I was. Are you watching the television? Are you aware? Do you know what's going on? What is happening? I save all of that stuff. And some of it you could throw out maybe one day, but you will believe me, there will be a day. I mean, my son's voices have raised 10 octaves by the time. I don't even recognize, unless he said, "Dad, this is Mike. I lost a tooth." You know what I mean? But you will cherish it, so just do it. That's my advice, I think. Hi, Paul.
Yeah. So any of us who have been interviewed by you notice that you listen in all kinds of ways. You listen with your eyes. You listen with you listen in many ways, and you obviously read in sense. You read volumes. Obviously, how do you prepare? How do you find time to prepare in which you're having to look at a manuscript, a book, etc.? And you asked me questions that let me know you knew things about me that I didn't know myself. I just wonder how you do that.
Here's the great secret to a good interview: is be prepared. And doing a daily program, it's difficult, because what we try to do is not have a book every other day. But there have been times, and it's exhausting. I'm decent. Terry Gross says it this way. She said she believed that her eye had to at least touch every page. In other words, I could maybe move past this part. And there are times, and there are those who are really good at it. Now, I am decent as a scanner sometimes if I don't have time. But I have to read it. Or at least I have to try to get it. And I think it's because I'm a little, seriously, I'm a little slow. I have to absolutely grab it. And I, Paul, operate under this fear constantly that there's going to be a moment of dead air when I have no idea what is going to happen next. And so I come to the desk, well, as you know, with 9 pages of questions. But see, the thing is you have to put that aside once it becomes a conversation. You know about where you're going, but you have to, if you just like, okay, great, 15, what are you doing? Then that doesn't work. You have to listen, I mean, because that's what a conversation is about. You know the direction you want to take it. So it's about being prepared, and it's about getting up. I get to the station at 5:30 in the morning. As Alice will tell you, what time did we get up this morning to get this damn thing put together? It was really early, and it's just a matter of, it was really early, and just it's being ready, you know. It's absolutely absorbing whatever you possibly can for everything. And there were things I found out about you in old interviews and stuff I had read that you had written before that I thought was interesting. And here's the other thing. Paying attention to the stuff that's written, what's the sort of subtext? Where did they get that? Neil LaBute, for example. There was some brutal, you know, in The Company of Men, that brutal, some of those scenes. Where in the hell did that come from? That's a legit question. And, you know, some of your poetry, I remember thinking, well, where did that come from, and what do I know about that? And pushing as far as you can. So it's trying to be ready. And you're not, I'm not always, believe me.
A difficult question. I'm just trying to get insight into your creative process. So two things. Is one thing you do very, very well is the mix metaphors that seem to relate, like you did in your speech about your son camping. So I'm interested in the sorts of things you read, because you seem to have a broad-based philosophical base. So I'm interested in what you read or how you try to stay informed. And the other thing is how you go about picking guests, what kind of subjects you want to follow up on. Do you have complete control over that? Okay.
Yeah, good. Okay. Yeah, I have complete control. We were talking about this the other day, too, that I'm a sort of a control freak when it comes to the show. And, well, ideas. I'll start with that one. I feel like that the people who listen to public radio, or certainly to my program, are kindred spirits in all kinds of different ways. And so when I'm interested in something, how many times have you, honestly, whether you wrote it down or not, thought when you're reading an article in the paper, some odd little tangent, well, where did that come from? Or what about that? Or I've always wondered about that. I do that constantly. And so I write it down. So I write down tons of ideas. And so story ideas are just, some of them are obvious, what's going on, what's happening. It's really important, though, that we focus on, I remember a couple of years ago, I think it was KSL, had a billboard campaign. Because he had a lot of money to do a billboard campaign, and it said, "When you need to know first." Do you remember that? "When you need to know first," which was nice and sort of quippy and made sense. And it's probably true. When if you see smoke in the valley, you probably don't go to KUER. You won't go to KSL. But I thought, you know, if public radio had money to do a billboard campaign, it would say, "When you need to know why." And so the whole idea is progressing the story. So when we sit down in a story idea meeting, we say, because we get this every once in a while. You should do something on polygamy. You know, you should do a show about domestic violence. And I always say, well, what about it? That's humongous. What about it? So we have to sit down and take the idea in its huge, amorphous, abstract ball and give it a focus, give it a kind of beginning, a middle, and an end. And that's sort of what we do. So that's that. As to reading, it's hard for me to read for pleasure these days. I've been trying to get through Never Let Me Go by the guy who wrote Remains of the Day. What's his last name? Ishiguro. You'll love it. I'll find it. Call me and I'll tell you if you want. But I've been trying to get through that thing for a long time because, you know, I'm trying to also get through this other stuff, but it's a real challenge. But you know what? I used to read a lot of plays because that's what I started doing. My goal was to be an actor. So I studied theater at the University of Utah. I got an acting scholarship and then chickened out. And I was thinking, well, what the hell am I going to do now? And because it's that thing. It's all of you who studied English lit. Your parents said, what in the hell are you going to do with that? And so it's the same thing with theater, but I sort of came to myself, well, what am I going to do with this? And I wimped out. And so I happened to find radio as a way of expressing your creativity. I liked story, so that's how I sort of came there. And I think there's a performance aspect to it as well. So I used to read a lot of plays. I've been hooked on nonfiction for a while too, and my wife who reads it voraciously. She reads much more than I. Is trying to get me back in good novels, and this is one. But so all kinds of stuff, all kinds of. I've been really interested. I love Shakespeare. I tell you, you can always go back there and make sense. And the great treasure of my life. I have an idea. Well, I'm going to do a show. I think it's going to be next week, and it's going to be around the anniversary of Katrina. So let me just invite you to listen, because here's the question I'm going to pose, and I'll get you thinking about this early. But it has to be a knee-jerk reaction, right? It is. If you had 15 minutes or less before the flood came, before the flames totally engulfed your house, what is the one thing you would take with you? What's the one thing you would grab? Don't tell me now. Rhetorical question now, but I'm going to ask it next week. And the one it's not actually, I don't know if this would be the thing I grab, but one of my great treasures is an old VHS copy of Ian McKellen acting. It's called Acting Shakespeare, when he celebrated the 1982 anniversary of the Folger Shakespeare Library, and he did this one-man show of Shakespeare. And I watch it once every couple of months, and I still am absolutely drawn to it. So there's that. Thanks very much.
We have about 15 minutes before the next session will begin, so take 5 or so minutes and chat, but we'd ask you to make room for the next session. Thank you so much.